What do you see when you look at these pictures? What do you feel? It's cute, right? I mean, don't they just give you all the warm, fuzzy feels? In 2015, this social media story went viral. Dubbed Death Row Dogs, it tells the story of two dogs in an animal rescue shelter that were adopted shortly after an image of them hugging was uploaded to the shelter's Facebook page, along with a caption written in the first-person persona of one of the dogs. Quote, "I'm Kayla and this is Kira. We're so scared in here. The people working in the shelter see how scared we are, but just told each other that today is our deadline. We have to have someone rescue us or we'll be next. Kira is black and not a real boxer, just a mix. She's so brave and tells me it will be okay no matter what happens. She tells me to be brave too, but I don't know if I can be. Can you see our faces? Kira knows what will happen. You can see it in her eyes. She's putting on a brave face for sure, but I can feel her heart beating fast while I'm clinging to her. If no one saves us, someone will take her away from me. I'll see her go down the hallway. She won't come back and I'll cry. They'll come for me next and I won't be as brave. We've comforted each other while we were here. She gave me hope when I had none. Now it's over. Unless." End quote. No doubt it tugs at your heartstrings. There is quite a large problem with this, however. The problem is that we have a tendency to anthropomorphize animals, particularly cute neotenous animals, and project our own emotions and our own behavioral intent onto them. But anyone who knows anything about canine psychology knows that dogs do not like to be hugged. Quote, "Dogs, like people, have a particular way of greeting, none of which involves having a foreleg over the shoulder," says applied animal behaviourist Dr. Patricia McConnell. "But dogs do put a leg over the shoulder of another, either one leg or both legs, and it's called standing over. It usually relates to some form of social status or perhaps competition for resources, so it is considered to be done by a dog who is trying to get some control." End quote. Looking at one of those earlier pictures with the benefit of hindsight, this golden retriever really doesn't look too thrilled about the arms wrapped around his neck. Far from a display of love, in dog body language, wrapping your arms around them is an overt show of social dominance, competition, and control, and most of the time, they don't fucking like it. In other words, what is happening in that picture of the two shelter dogs is actually an overt display of dominance and control. Emotionally, we have the situation exactly ass backwards, so much so that whoever wrote that Facebook post has incorrectly projected an entire fictional narrative of human emotion, human behavior, and human self-awareness onto these naive animals, which many people who saw the post seem to have accepted wholesale. According to the article, both dogs were adopted 2 hours after the Facebook post went live. This is another article discussing the Utah Humane Society's similar approach of putting their rescue dogs in a photo booth to take anthropomorphized photos, many of them wearing human pieces of clothing like scarves. Do these dogs like wearing scarves? I fucking doubt it, but apparently potential dog owners love seeing them wearing scarves. Since embracing this social media strategy, their live adoption rate has skyrocketed to over 90%. But we're slowly drifting off topic. The point to all of this is that the human brain isn't wired primarily for rationality, and the stronger irrational emotions like empathy, particularly if misinterpreted or misdirected, can lead to some rather poor decision making. I think Jay Bauman of Half in the Bag summed it up perfectly when he said that Grizzly Man, the Werner Herzog biopic about the late Timothy Treadwell, should have really been retitled "They're Bears, You Fucking Idiot." Unlike prancing around with wild grizzly bears, you may not think that adopting a dog from the local shelter is a particularly irrational thing. I for one rather like dogs myself, but the fact that these two dogs sat in an adoption shelter for 2 or 3 months and were then suddenly adopted exactly 2 hours and 6 minutes after a social media photo depicting them quote-unquote hugging in what can only be categorized as a colossal misunderstanding of canine behavior leads me to think that their new forever home didn't happen as a result of rational consideration by their new human owner. Clearly, the tendency of both shelter workers and potential owners to anthropomorphize these dogs, regardless of what their actual canine behavior represents, has had a strong emotional effect and, dare I say, manipulative influence over the decision-making of people who might potentially adopt them. But beyond our interaction with dogs and grizzly bears, the ultimate question is, how deep does this emotional misunderstanding and projection go, and do we do this with other people rather than just other animals? Well, the short answer is yes, and it's quite prevalent when it comes to emotional and behavioural differences in men and women, particularly where sex, relationships, and courtship is concerned. Not to be confused with terror management theory, which has been discussed extensively by Barbarossa, Stardust, and others, error management theory, to quote Wikipedia, is an extensive theory of perception and cognitive bias created by David Buss and Marty Hasselton. Effectively, the theory outlines two main types of perceptive errors that occur during interactions. A type 1 is a false positive. The example given by Wikipedia is acting on a fire alarm that turns out to be false. Type 1 is effectively what happened in the story about the death row dogs. Human emotions and intent were falsely perceived in the dog's behavior, when in fact the behavior actually means something very, very different in dog psychology. Type 2 is a false negative error, ignoring the fire alarm that turns out to be accurate due to skepticism. You know, it's probably just a drill. So, to summarize error management theory, women tend to make type 2 or false negative errors because for them, it's economically better to falsely assume a lack of interest on the part of the man than incur the reproductive cost of mating with the wrong kind of non-committal partner. Men, on the other hand, tend towards type 1 or false positive errors. They assume sexual interest on the part of the woman they're interacting with, where there actually might not be any, because to them, sleeping with as many women as possible maximizes their potential for gene propagation. This makes a lot of sense and fits rather nicely with Girl Writes What's Old economic analogy that, in terms of reproductive cost-benefit, renting a womb for 9 months is worth $1 million, whereas the teaspoon of protein that a man gives up and is then good to go less than an hour later is worth maybe 10 cents a pop. Now, ultimately, what error management theory essentially proposes is that men and women are taking these internal instinctual strategies of best reproductive practice for themselves and then projecting them onto the opposite sex, essentially forming a perceptive bias in the other person's behavioral or emotional intent. The Wiki article ultimately goes on to explain what was reported about male sexual and commitment self-interest was also true of women. They self-reported levels of sexual interest and desire for commitment, which also predicted their perceptions of their partner's sexual interest and desire for commitment. This implies that instead of males and females falling victim to overperception and underperception respectively, both sexes projected their own level of interest onto the individuals they were interacting with. Now, I'm no expert on the subject, but from what I have read, confusion surrounding sexual intent seems to be the main focus of Buss and Hasselton's theory. Wikipedia's description concludes that, quote, error management theory asserts that evolved mind-reading agencies will be biased to produce more of one type of inferential error than another. Just as an aside, when they say mind-reading here, they're not talking about anything supernatural, but rather the ability to pick up on non-verbal cues from others, but I'll continue. These mind-reading biases have been further researched in terms of the mating world. Error management theory provides a clear explanation for the discovery that men have a tendency to perceive women as having greater sexual interest in them than is present, if they smile or touch them, and females have a tendency to underplay a man's interest in them, even if it is quite strong. End quote. All very interesting stuff, but when we move past the narrow field of human courtship and reproduction, it appears that the propensity for men and women to commit type 1 and type 2 errors respectively is completely flipped on its head. In almost every other aspect of life, whether it be hobbies, employment, education, whatever, it would appear that women primarily concerned with personal safety and risk avoidance commit mainly type 1 false positive errors, perceiving all manner of environmental risks where there are none. Now, Tildy recently made a phenomenal video about the methodological problems behind the cultural male and female norms inventory. So he's welcome to correct me if I'm completely wrong here, but this doesn't seem to be anecdotal stereotyping based on the subjective opinions of a poorly constructed focus group. There does actually seem to be ample data to support the claim that there are some very, very real fundamental differences in the way the average man and the average woman perceive and process the world around them, specifically the world of risk. For instance, this polling data from Gallup clearly and consistently shows that across every stage of life, women express being more worried and more stressed on a daily basis than their male counterparts. Even as stress and worry levels noticeably drop after retirement age, women still remain considerably more stressed and more worried about the world around them than the men in their same age groups. Men, on the other hand, commit more type 2 errors, often underestimating or downplaying real risks because they're primarily performance driven, and sometimes you just have to get the job done no matter what. There is a reason why on-the-job deaths are 95% male, and it's got nothing to do with third-wave feminists talking smack on Twitter. Men pursue more dangerous jobs and they take more risks in those jobs. I know a lot of these rah-rah pro-male activists don't want to admit this, but in the overwhelming majority of cases, men are the architects of their own disposability. Now, there's really no shortage of additional data you can find to fit perfectly into this framework. As a motorcycle rider, I found this Revzilla article particularly interesting. Number of women riders hits an all-time high. What is that high? 14%. Clearly, the risks involved with this hobby attract vastly more men than women. As an additional anecdote, of all the female riders I've known in my life, more than half of them have either been openly bisexual or full-blown lesbians. I would hazard a guess that there are probably some very real neurological and hormonal differences in the women who willingly choose to engage in these kinds of risky, dangerous, overwhelmingly male hobbies, but that's really a video for another time. Getting back on topic, this flip is not even a huge jump from the original theory when you actually think about it. In terms of gender interaction, the female type 2 error described by Buss and Hasselton's theory is effectively about reproductive risk mitigation, and the male's type 1 false positive is about reproductive risk taking. The cognitive errors change, but they're still ultimately in aid of the same gendered goals. I don't know, I guess if you wanted to invent some nomenclature, you could take a leaf out of Einstein's book and call the courtship aspect special error management theory and the wider societal stuff general error management theory or something to that effect. Either way, the implications of this flip resulting in general error management theory are huge when it comes to things like workplace etiquette. But first, I want to talk a little bit about a well-known psychological phenomenon called pareidolia. The human brain is wired to be very good at pattern recognition. So good, in fact, that oftentimes it will recognize patterns that aren't actually there. Animals in clouds, Jesus in burnt toast, smiling faces in just about every object you can think of. Now, that last one should give you a bit of a hint as to what is going on neurologically. The Evo Psych explanation for this phenomenon is basically a textbook type 1 error. If you're wandering through the jungle, the cost benefit of falsely perceiving eyes and a mouth amongst the foliage is much better than, you know, missing a real saber-toothed tiger who wants to turn you into dinner. There are very real evolutionary reasons why the human brain is so sensitive to this pattern recognition and why it often results in false positive errors. Now, it's hard to know exactly what goes on inside the mind of other animals like dogs and grizzly bears, but we know pareidolia isn't limited to the human brain, because we've literally engineered and recreated this cognitive bias in artificial intelligence systems. I'm sure many of you are familiar with these images. Google's Deep Dream software is not simply a quaint little image filter for your Snapchats. It is essentially the same artificial neural network developed by Google for their image recognition needs, except it is run in reverse through a feedback loop. It takes an image, it looks for features it thinks are there, and when it thinks it's found a recognizable feature, it exaggerates that feature and projects that exaggeration back onto the original picture. After successive iterations, you end up with a very surreal misinterpretation of the original image. Through the chaos, if you squint, you can actually still quite clearly make out the original image. This one, for instance, being Angela Merkel. Here we have Obama, Jennifer Lawrence, not quite as hot with a dog face. The features it mistakenly thinks it recognizes, like the floating eyes all over the place, are effectively false positive errors that are then projected back onto the original subject. In the context of what we've been talking about here, Google's Deep Dream is quite literally a type 1 perceptive bias error generator. And I think by examining what's happening inside the black box of Google Deep Dream, we can perhaps gain some new insight into the function, or rather malfunction, of the human black box as well. Probably the most important component in the cognitive bias generated by Google's artificial intelligence system is its underlying knowledge base. How does it actually recognize features, and in what way is it biased? This is from a very interesting article on Fast Code Design titled "Why Google's Deep Dream AI Hallucinates in Dog Faces." Quote, "As you may know, Google's Deep Dream runs off the same type of neural network that powers Google Photos' ability to identify images by their content. Essentially, the network emulates the neurons in the human brain, with a single core of the network firing every time it sees a part of the image it thinks it recognizes. Where do the dogs come in? This Reddit thread provides some insight. A neural network's ability to recognize what is in an image comes from being trained on an initial data set. In Deep Dream's case, that data set is from ImageNet, a database created by researchers at Stanford and Princeton who built a database of 14 million human-labeled images. But Google didn't use the whole data set. Instead, they used a smaller subset of the ImageNet database released in 2012 for use in a contest, a subset which contained fine-grained classifications of 120 dog subclasses. In other words, Google's Deep Dream sees dog faces everywhere because it was literally trained to see dog faces everywhere." End quote. So this computer pareidolia simulator more or less reaffirms what we already know about the human brain from error management theory. Perception bias is informed by what the observer already knows and believes. That bias is then mentally projected back onto whatever subject is being observed, until the subject, now removed from reality, completely reflects the observer's own cognitive bias. In the case of dog owners, their own human emotions and intentions are projected onto their pet's behavior. In the case of Google Deep Dream, it sees dog faces everywhere. In the case of men, they perceive sexual interest on the part of women they interact with. And in the general case of women, they project environmental risk based on concern for their own personal safety. In this sense, error management theory can be thought of as a form of behavioral or emotional pareidolia. Based on their own personal biases, people think they recognize behavioral and emotional intent that isn't actually there. For women in particular, overly concerned with personal safety above all else, this specifically manifests as a fear-based pareidolia where they are constantly at risk from some erroneously perceived threat. Now, this output bias and projection apparently has some very interesting and unexpected consequences as the environmental input changes. When you ask Google's Deep Dream to look for architectural features in a mountain, you end up with something that resembles a Chinese watercolour painting. It has a clear starting point to work with, so it adds what it thinks it should see, and based on prior experience, what it thinks it should see in the mountains are Chinese pagodas. The surreal pareidolic elements dreamt up by Google's AI neural network are clearly visible, but the original image is still fairly recognisable and you can take a good guess at the so-called thought process that Deep Dream has gone through to arrive at this final image. However, when you ask Google's Deep Dream to look for those same architectural features in white noise, it turns into a veritable clusterfuck of random architectural elements emerging out of nowhere. It's basically computer-simulated psychosis, probably not unlike the hallucinations reported by people undergoing severe sensory deprivation. Without a concrete, real-world starting point, Deep Dream's artificial imagination basically flips its shit and overloads. So, what do you think will happen when a person with this highly evolved safety-seeking and risk-perceiving bias is placed in the safest, most secure society that has ever existed in human history? There's no risk of being marauded by the next village over. You're not going to go hungry with the supermarket down the road, and even if you lose your job, you have welfare to rely on. Well, the research is a little all over the place, but the general consensus seems to be that mood disorders, depression being the most commonly cited, are a relatively recent phenomenon belonging to modern society. The tribes of Papua New Guinea, for example, do not suffer depression, or at least nowhere near the scale of the so-called depression epidemic currently sweeping modern industrialized societies. According to the research that I could find, developing nations fall somewhere in the middle, with apparently up to 3.5% of women in developing nations suffering from disorders like bulimia nervosa, almost exactly half the rate observed in Western women, with stats ranging up to 7.3%. Translating the science into internet meme speak, depression is a first world problem. It's funny, right? I mean, not the meme, but the fact that as life gets safer and easier, we actually seem to get more stressed and more depressed. There was actually a particularly interesting keynote by Robert Sapolsky you can find here on YouTube called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. Essentially, the physiological stress responses of biological organisms were never meant to be subjected to a grueling 40-hour work week full of deadlines, key performance indicators, electricity bills, strict timetables, and so on. But I digress. The research in all these areas comes up a little short. There's virtually no crossover between them, so my conclusions here are somewhat speculative, but I can't help but think that all of these things are somehow connected. Error management, pareidolia, and the observable rates of mood disorders in the first world. I suspect that like Google's Deep Dream AI, in the absence of real-world risk, the human brain, particularly the female brain, evolutionarily programmed to detect and avoid risk patterns, will continue generating type 1 errors. But without anything tangible in the real world to work from, it is essentially recognizing and exaggerating these risk patterns out of otherwise environmental white noise. Women are constantly worried about their personal safety, so they project and perceive the environment around them as being unsafe. And as the real-world environment around them objectively continues to get safer and safer, their false positive errors get more and more bizarre. As the proverb goes, idle hands are the devil's plaything. Well, I'd hazard a guess that idle minds are the same. Where Google's Deep Dream hallucinates a cascade of water fountains out of nothing but white noise, women begin to see oppressive patriarchal sexism in air conditioning. It was rather interesting to watch the befuddled reactions of anti-feminists to the whole sexist air conditioning debacle. I don't know, are we actually calling it air conditioner gate yet? Anyway, it seems like many of these self-proclaimed rationalists couldn't manage to rationalise the female thought process here, so they just cynically assumed it was the intentional, hyperbolic attention-seeking campaign of crazed ideologues. Well, it's not a joke or a ruse or an attention-seeking ploy. I think these women really do believe that the current standard of air conditioning is sexist and specifically designed to oppress them as women in the office workplace. And I've begun hearing this sentiment about office temperature from more and more nominally non-feminist women. It is frankly a world gone topsy-turvy where I, the God Emperor of cynicism, should have to be the one who takes this position, but I genuinely believe these women at their word. I'm honestly not sure whether the lack of understanding here is simply a result of blindness or straight up arrogance, but if you actually bother listening to what women have been saying, they have been continually and consistently explaining their reasoning the entire time. Anita Sarkeesian said that everything is sexist, everything is racist, everything is homophobic, and you have to point it all out. Lacey Green said that literally everyone and everything is problematic. I think they really do believe what they're saying. And whilst these two in particular are rather obnoxious, loudmouth feminists, I also don't really think they're outliers to the general female mindset of false positive risk perception and projection. In today's world, these women literally have no tangible starting point for their risk over perception bias to work from. So they subsequently perceive the entire world as a risk. Everything is sexist, everything is racist, everything is problematic. What you are seeing here is literally the female psychological equivalent of deep dreams cascading water fountains emerging out of nothing but white noise. And I think a lot of the things about the real world begin to make more sense in light of this female cascade of paranoia. Is it any wonder that 75% of HR managers and somewhere between 60 and 72% of compliance managers are female? Regardless of who's actually doing the real work on the factory floor, the overwhelming majority of work health and safety regulations are being crafted by women. Now, I should point out that this in itself isn't entirely a bad thing. I mean, workplace safety didn't really exist before women entered the workforce, and a lot of male lives have been saved as a peripheral result of these working women's ongoing concern for improved safety. The problem is that whilst real safety shortcomings have been addressed, female type 1 cognitive risk assessment biases have slowly but surely been working their way into these ongoing regulatory revisions and legislation. What you are looking at here is the assessment task for a recent work health and safety training seminar that I and other colleagues had to attend on the subject of workplace harassment. Judging by the pink highlighter scribbled all over it, I apparently didn't do so well. You'll notice on question 1 addressing inappropriate workplace behaviour, the inclusion of things like ogling. Apparently, it is now legally official in my workplace that if a woman feels that you've looked at her the wrong way, then you have actually broken some very tangible workplace health and safety regulations. I find question 5 equally interesting. Ignoring and/or excluding a person whom you find difficult are forms of bullying. In other words, if you're not super best friends with everyone in your workplace, then you are somehow actively harassing your colleagues. As the workplace and wider society continues to get safer and easier, these female type 1 errors will continue to get more and more disconnected from anything real, ultimately resulting in nonsense like sexist air conditioning. This, I think, is one of the great failings of the anti-feminist and MRA crowd. They often rail against these sorts of sensationalist news stories, pumping out numerous response videos poking fun at how stupid feminists are, but they never take the time to try and understand the underlying thought process which actually led these women to that position in the first place. See, I don't think these feminist women, or women in general for that matter, are stupid. I think, like the looped iterations of Google Deep Dream's neural network, these women are actually rationally moving through a series of discrete cognizant steps, but they are working on the basis of an erroneous overperception bias due to flawed female risk assessment. Given how easily we can project human emotions onto dogs and make hugely erroneous assumptions about their behavioural motives, it's hardly a stretch to imagine that a woman, completely self-obsessed with personal safety to a degree that could be described paranoid, might project and thus perceive a real sense of threat and intentional malice from the office air conditioning unit. You know, it's very easy to cynically write off sexist air conditioning as a shameless feminist publicity ploy, but I honestly think that would be a mistake. A mistake that would ignore the reality of the female condition. See, the overwhelming majority of those female HR managers whom I've met personally, including my current HR manager, are not full-blown, patriarchy-smashing feminazi zealots all engaged in some vast malicious conspiracy to fuck over all men in the great ideological gender war of insert current year. When you actually bother to look at the data, it becomes painfully obvious why concerns like the wicked male gaze are slowly starting to work their way into official industry legislation. This graph from Gallup shows that, based on their polling, 1/3 of all American women basically live in constant fear of being sexually assaulted. Now, studies have shown that being involved in feminism and gender politics does create bias and increase the level of sexism an individual perceives in the world around them. However, while statistics do vary depending on the source, other extensive polls by organizations like the Huffington Post have also shown that as few as 23% of those very same American women actually identify as feminists. Even if every single one of those self-identified feminist women in the Huffington Post poll also answered that they were constantly worried about being sexually assaulted, we are still left with a shortfall of 10% to explain the total number of women we see in the Gallup poll. What we are really looking at here, as Stardust would say, are lowercase f feminists, regular women acting on regular female psychology. To them, female interests and female safety always comes first, and things like the glance of an undesirable man, or everyone in the office being forced to pretend like they're BFFs, these are not the academic concerns of ideological gender feminism, but the real concerns and real feelings of regular, everyday women in the workplace. This isn't about ideology, this is about innate human psychology. This is about the grassroots fears of everyday people, specifically everyday women, which the top-level cultural ideologies simply tend to reflect. Or to paraphrase, feminism is the politicization of innate female nature. This is abundantly clear in the fact that the Gallup statistics seems to consistently hold steady all the way back to the first year of polling in 2000. Well and truly predating the recent rise of the batshit insane social justice movement. It predates tropes versus women in video games. It predates Elevatorgate. It predates Gamergate. It predates the Young Turks and AJ Plus and Jezebel and feministing. Looking at the actual data, none of these things seem to have had any significant or noticeable impact on the collective mindset of American women. The development of Web 2.0, along with its new communication platforms like WordPress, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Tumblr, and so on, have simply allowed these women to more freely and more widely express their pathological fears about the world around them. But clearly, the rapid growth of online feminism over the last 5 to 10 years didn't create these female fears in the first place. It actually fed off innate fears that were already present. I mean, consider the fact that Lacey Green was apparently only 11 years old when the first polling statistic of 36% was recorded. It should be abundantly clear that Lacey Green's current MTV exploits are the symptom of an underlying problem, not the cause of those problems. Making videos about how dumb she is may provide some light entertainment for those who already agree with you, but let's not pretend it's actually going to change anything. It's not without a little irony that the closest many of these anti-feminist idiots ever get to a causal explanation for this female behaviour is to blame it all on cultural Marxist brainwashing. Ooh, the ghost of Karl Marx done tricked all the lady folk. It's ironic because I cannot think of a better example to illustrate this kind of mass fear-based pareidolia than the Red Scare. The risk of long-range nuclear war was present, but within their own little white picket fence communities, average American citizens were just about the safest and most comfortable they had ever been in human history. I mean, so much so that many of these very same anti-feminists see the 1950s as being a golden age that they somehow want to get back to. Golden age. Well, when left to the comfort of their own safe little closed communities, this golden age ran rampant with crazed delusional paranoia. Hell, you'd think there were communist spies lurking around the corner of every 1950s milk bar just waiting to jump out and get you. The famous stage play The Crucible was actually written at the time as a social commentary that likened McCarthyism to a modern-day witch hunt, with people encouraged to turn friends and neighbours into the authorities as suspected communists. To paraphrase the 1950s McCarthyist mindset using the words of our very own Anita Sarkeesian, everyone's a communist, everyone's a Marxist, and you have to point it all out. Well, the Cold War ended, the Soviet Union collapsed, and people now look back on Joe McCarthy as the paranoid fucking moron he was. But surprise, surprise, people's innate tendency to perceive and project their own biases and fears onto, you know, the other people and environments around them didn't magically go away. Things haven't really changed that much. Now we just have a new slew of imaginary boogeymen to project our fears and problems onto. For feminism, it's the patriarchy. For MRAs, it's feminism. The alt-right blames the Jew. Black Lives Matter thinks it's all the fault of the white devil, and so on. But beyond these short-sighted ideologies, each fighting for their fair share of scraps at the political table, what we are really left with is people. Actual, real men and women with all of their shitty, evolved behavioural maladaptations. What I'm getting at here is that modern work health and safety legislation and even laws beyond the workplace like VAWA are all effectively the codification of general error management theory. What is ultimately being legislated here is not really ideology, but rather plain old regular human psychology. And specifically female psychology. You can look at any society at any point in history, and the unwritten law is always women and children first. Well, the environment and specifically the workplace has changed from the days of yore, but people's evolved psychology has not. Women are still primarily concerned with themselves. Men are still primarily concerned with women. So in the modern absence of real environmental risk, I suspect their increasingly bizarre cognitive biases and projections will continue to become law.